seems like there's some repetition here in these chapters, in chapters 28 and 29. We've covered this material twice before, mostly. Most of the material was there in Exodus 23 and Leviticus 23. And it concerns God's holy feast days, his convocations, when the people are called out to worship him. Why is there repetition in this place, in these two chapters? In the commentaries, there's a whole lot of discussion about why that would be. But I could think of several reasons. God is a God of repetition. We've seen that over and over again in our study in the Bible. It's been 38 years or so since the people have heard this, most likely, since Sinai. And the people are now about to cross over into the promised land, into the land of Canaan. And the unity of the people is about to end. I was thinking about that. You know, when you're trekking together through the wilderness, there's an imposed unity that you have to function as a group. But once you get into the promised land, you're going to separate, go to your allotted territory, 12 tribes, and so on. And God is reminding them now, here is what, he's really looking past the battle of getting into the promised land and looking to the time of peace and prosperity. Here's what is expected of you through the centuries, through time, as time progresses. And this is what the Jewish people did for 1,500 years. They kept the holy convocations of Israel, the feasts of Israel. And let's see if this works. I tried to do a timeline thing. I pulled out that old program I used a couple years ago and just go through some of these feasts. The first is Passover, which of course commemorates the Exodus. Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days after the Passover, where the people cast all the unleavened bread out of their house. During that week, there is the first fruits of the barley harvest. And then 50 days later after Passover, there is the Feast of Weeks, which in the New Testament's Pentecost. Then in the fall, around September, is the Feast of Trumpets on the first, same month, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, on the 10th. And then a seven-day Feast of Tabernacles beginning on the 15th, the Feast of Booths. So that's what we're looking at. I thought it was kind of neat to see it that way. And then I found this. Also, this gives us a pretty good idea of these worship feasts, these holy times that the Lord has set aside. Here we are. Today is May the 17th, so you can look here on the calendar. And Passover is in Nisan. It is the 14th of Nisan, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread is in this same month. First, that barley, first fruits, is on that first Lord's Day after Passover, first day of the week. And then you go 50 days after Passover to Pentecost, and that's in this Jewish month of Sivan, if that's how you pronounce it. And so it is the Feast of Weeks, as it is called here, Pentecost. And then you skip forward, these are the spring months, and you skip forward all the way to the fall, down here in the month of Tishri, in September and October. And it begins with the Feast of Trumpets on the first day of Tishri, and then the Day of Atonement on the 10th day of Tishri, and then a week-long Feast of Tabernacles, where the people make booths, and they live outside their homes, and it's a day, a time of great joy and excitement. So that's what we're looking at. And that brings us then to question number one. I think Bill had the last question last time, if I remember correctly. So that would move us back to Grant. Grant, the question is, before detailing a host of sacrifices Israel was to make throughout the year, how did God preface his instructions?
I'll take all
of them. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I missed you, Lance.
That's all right.
Well, from what I understand, it was kind of a reminder, but more of a warning, I think, to Moses and the children of Israel about the commandments that had already been determined. God's people had certainly not been able, for many reasons, to observe all the sacrifices and ordinances commanded on Sinai. But as we have seen through the sin and the rebellion, that people have disobeyed the ordinances commanded by God. So I believe it's appropriate that there's a stress on the timing and duties that they're to be following as they enter the land of Canaan.
Other comments on the preface that God gives to his instructions here? Yes, Florence.
In verse 2, it says, my offering, my food, my offering. So my food kind of made me think of Psalm 50, where God says, for the every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle of 1,000 hills are mine. So he talks about how he owns all that. And then, you know, here it's talking about the specificity of how to worship. But in Psalms, it talks about you need that. But then it goes on to say you can't neglect righteousness and so forth. Down in verse 16 of that says, but the wicked, to the wicked God says, what right have you to declare my statute, to take my covenant in your mouth, seeing you hate instruction and cast my words behind you? When you saw a thief, you consented with him and have been partaker with adulterers. You give your mouth to evil and your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's sons. These things you have done, and I have kept silent, but thought it was altogether like you. But I will rebuke you and set them in order before your eyes.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, Sean.
The word offering here is the Hebrew word korban, which literally means presentation, something that is presented unto the Lord. But as Lauren was saying, this expression, my offering, my food, is actually a bit unusual. The technical term for food here probably is meant to figuratively depict what would be consumed on the altar. And actually, it's important to note that one of the stark differences between God's sacrificial system and that which was performed by the pagans is that idol worshippers believed when they were offering meat or food before their idols that they were providing food for the gods to eat. This was a very common idea. In fact, there were priests who would make elaborate scenes of people bringing the food to the altar, and then the priest would come in and take the food and consume parts of it, and then the next day the people would come back and they would say, well, the gods have come down and feasted on our sacrifices. And so the psalm that Lauren mentioned, Psalm 50, is very important for this reason, because the purpose of this section of the psalm that Lauren was discussing is God saying, all of this is already mine. And I think verse 12, Psalm 50, verse 12, is very important. If I were hungry, God says, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all its fullness. God's saying, these things are already mine. It's not that I'm coming to you to provide me with anything that I don't already have or that I can't take for myself. So sacrifices under the law of Moses were not meant in some mystical way to provide sustenance to the Lord. In fact, what they're described as in Psalm 50 as expressions of love and devotion and thanksgiving. And I think that's especially important. Also, of course, sacrifices were means of making atonement, offering blood to cover the sins of the people, something that would take their punishment, and an innocent animal taking their punishment. So all of these sacrifices, this incredible number of animals that was killed every year, as we'll discuss throughout these two chapters, which are all in addition to voluntary free will offerings, which are mentioned at the very end of chapter 29. All of this exorbitant amount of blood being shed was all for the people to express their love, their devotion, their commitment. That's what a sacrifice is. A sacrifice is giving something up for the Lord as an expression of your thanksgiving for what he's done for you.
Very good. Taylor.
Yeah, many of the phrases that we see in verse 2 are also phrases that have been used already in Leviticus, particularly Korban, as Jahim mentioned in Leviticus 1:2. Bread of Jehovah is mentioned in Leviticus 3:11, and the idea of a sweet aroma, sacrifice being a sweet aroma, is mentioned in Leviticus 1:9. So perhaps there's some repetition to your point originally in that the same figures of speech are used here. But to go off of Lance's point and prefacing these two chapters, these were intended mostly for a settled people, particularly harvest feasts, people who would be able to bring these drink offerings, these grain offerings forward. And then what you said at the very beginning, reasons potentially for this, you hinted at it as well, but keep in mind the vast majority of Israel never heard these directly. You know, to your point, it's been 38 years, the majority have died. And so it was necessary not only in preparation for going across, but also to remind the people who otherwise might have gotten it second or third hand what exactly they were going to be required to do, because obviously the way they did it was important.
Well, I was kind of the idea of how did God preface his instructions. I kind of went to the end of verse 2. Be careful. Be careful to offer it to me at their appointed time.
Yeah, just another difference between this chapter and chapter 29 and Leviticus, that Leviticus was for the priests. Those were instructions that were given to Moses and Aaron to be handed out to the priests. Whereas here, perhaps unusual, but for here, here the command is to the children of Israel. And that's stated in verse 2 and at the end of chapter 29. So these instructions are being given to all the people, because even though the sacrifices are going to be performed by the priests as representatives of the people, they will have a part in all of these feasts. Of course, their tithes provided these animals, and then there's convocations and other components of these, cessation of work and so on and so forth, that would be applicable to their daily lives.
Very good. I appreciate all those comments. The way I took this was God saying, these are my traditions. And they're my holy convocations. Don't make anything up. And I thought of 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2, keep the traditions just as they've been delivered. And, of course, our tendency is to add stuff in, to make a new holiday that's not in the Scripture, to do whatever it is we wish. And I thought of when we studied in Exodus about don't boil the kid in its mother's milk, and then Matt Kuderna brought out that it was a Ugaritic custom, a pagan custom, and it was this sort of thing. It was this kind of feast that the pagans would boil a kid in its mother's milk. And in the book of Exodus, when God is talking about these very festivals, he says, don't do that. And so what he's saying is, for me, and I certainly agree with what's been said, but the emphasis I saw was, this is how I want it done. Don't change it. Don't. And the people, of course, did. Down through century after century, they adulterated it and altered it and, you know, built altars to Baal in their backyard and so on and so forth. That's what all the book of Judges is about. Any other comments before we move on? All right, Grant, I think maybe I'll double check.
Yes.
It does look like you. Question number 2, three types of sacrifices are discussed in these verses. With what frequency were they offered?
All right, so we see in verses 3 through 8, it discusses here a regular offering for the morning and the evening. And we see from the context of how it's used in the verses that we'll come to later on in this chapter and the next chapter, discusses daily how things are done. It says inside that the regular offering. So you can kind of infer that it's daily offerings. Specifically, these regular offerings are every single day. And then we see in verses 9 and 10, talks about the Sabbath offering, so every 7 days that they're offered. And then verses 11 through 15, about the monthly offerings. So these are things that are done, of course, always with the daily offering in mind, not with the Sabbath are always done as well. So these are things that are regularly done every day, every week, and every month.
Very good. Thank you. Other comments on this frequency and the type? Okay.
No. Just a couple quick observations on this. Verse 3, it mentions a lamb without blemish, and certainly that language is familiar to us. It's used with Christ in Hebrews 9:14 and 1 Peter 1:19. Certainly that was important to the old law and for the new covenant as well, the sacrifice of a blemishless lamb. And then for the feast of the new moon, that was kind of interesting, the way some of these changed throughout history. By the time of Isaiah, this had become a day of rest and worship. We read that in Isaiah 66, verse 23, so almost a monthly Sabbath to start out. And there was feasting as well, we see in 1 Samuel 20, verse 5. So the idea of a feast, festival, something for the moon, was somewhat of a common occurrence among different cultures throughout history. But here it's dedicated to the Lord. This is specifically when you see this, you know, this is something that is to be done to the Lord as a religious thing. So it's sort of interesting, you know, we don't really think about celestial events much anymore, but there is something sort of powerful about seeing the moon change. And so God says, when you see that, you know, I remember me in this way, the way I've asked you to do it. And then one thing on the drink offering that is mentioned here. The drink offering, it's not really specified here, but Philippians 2:17 seems to indicate that it was poured onto the sacrifice. And then the word, very interesting, it's shikar, if I'm saying that correctly, and it's strong drink, is the way it's rendered in other places, such as Leviticus 10:9. So this was often used of a drink that wasn't made with grapes, something analogous to beer. And so there's also a considerable amount at play as well. I think I read about a quart as equivalent to the measure here. So this was a significant amount of beverage poured on this.
I always, every time we cover this, I forget how much it is. And so to try and remember, a hen is 3.67 liters. So whatever percentage of a hen, and here's, this kind of gives us an idea of what that size might be. And then an ephah is a dry weight, so a wet weight, and then ephah is a dry weight, and it would be 22 liters of grain. And so again, whatever percentage of an ephah that would be. Yes, Sean.
In the first set of chapters of Leviticus, we studied five different types of sacrifices: burnt offering, grain, fellowship, sin, and trespass. Those are the five types of offerings discussed in those chapters. And all of these, the daily, the weekly, and the monthly, they all centered around a burnt offering. And in our study of Leviticus 1, which outlines the parameters for a burnt offering, we noticed that a burnt offering was different from some of the other types of offerings because a burnt offering was entirely consumed on the altar. It's totally given to the Lord. It was meant entirely for Him. There was no priestly portion for them to eat. There was no portion for the worshipers to consume. It was all for God. So every day, in the morning and in the evening, the priests, whatever work they were going to do that day, would bookend the day with something totally for the Lord. And every Sabbath, as the people rested from their labor and remembered the deliverance that God worked for them, bringing them out of bondage, they would add another burnt offering, something given just to the Lord. Every month, as the moon made its full cycle and they began a new month in their lunar calendar, a sacrifice just for the Lord, to thank Him for what He did the previous month and to prepare them for what was to come. So, aside from all of the festivals, which we're about to get into, this was something that would be just for God. It would remind them every single day that what they were doing was for the Lord.
Very good. Yeah, and I like the progression from daily to weekly to monthly, and then we get into the annual at the end of 28 and all of 29. And Tyndale said that every year, so these were all cumulative, you would have a daily sacrifice of two lambs, and on the Sabbath you would add two more, so you would have four. And Tyndale said that there was a total per year of 113 bulls, 32 rams, 1,086 lambs, more than a ton of flour, and 1,000 bottles of oil and wine. So if those figures are correct, it was a large amount that was sacrificed to the Lord. All right, we'll move on then to question number three. And Wes, this will be for you. What sacrifices and other events were connected to Passover?
So the Passover, verse 16 tells us that the Passover came on the 14th day of the month. And then the day following that was the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Festival of Unleavened Bread. It lasted a week, and on the first day of the festival, they were to rest from their work. They were to come together for worship in the convocation. They were then to bring to the altar two bulls, a full-grown ram, seven-year-old rams that are unblemished. And then they were to do a grain offering of several ephahs. I have 6 pounds as the equivalent of flour mixed with olive oil. Four equivalent to 4 pounds offered to the ram, with the ram, and 2 pounds of flour mixed with oil to be offered with the young rams. And then they were to also offer a goat as a sacrifice for atonement. These were all to be offered in addition to these daily sacrifices we just spoke of, to be a sweet smelling aroma. On the last day of the festival, they were to again rest from their work.
Good summary, thank you. Other comments on Passover?
Just as a reminder that this instruction is surrounding the tabernacle and the temple activities. So not mentioned here are the family obligations for Passover, where each family would gather together, would roast, sacrifice a lamb, spread the blood, roast it, eat it. a bit with the bitter herbs, unleavened bread. That's not treated here because this is just about what happens in the tabernacle service. So that is an addition. All of this is an addition to what each family would do on its own for Passover.
I was a little unclear on that because later, obviously, in Deuteronomy, perhaps we're told the three great festivals that all men have to go to Jerusalem for, and Passover is one of those. So at that time, is it your understanding that they stopped doing the local? If the men were going on the pilgrimage for Passover, for the unleavened bread, for Pentecost, and for tabernacles, I think those were the three, did they cease doing individual homes at that time? Or I'm a little unclear of that. If the men were all making this pilgrimage to Jerusalem for Passover.
In the New Testament, it seems that continued to be the practice. They continued to celebrate Passover as a family, as Jesus and the disciples did during the final week. There are four Passovers mentioned in John's Gospel and specifies in most of those that Jesus went to Jerusalem. So whether that meant that they went to Jerusalem and had their feast there, or they had the feast in their homes and then went to Jerusalem, maybe there's some discussion about how exactly the timeline worked. Or some of the men went and some stayed home, and whoever stayed home conducted the feast. I don't know that there's a regulation for the Passover that everyone in the family has to be there, but whoever is there in the household, one lamb per family and those kinds of things.
Yes, I agree. I think Wes summarized very good. This Passover, it was originally in the month of Abib, but once the Babylonian captivity occurred, the name was changed to Nisan. During this time, Deuteronomy 16 verse 3 tells us that the unleavened bread was the bread of affliction, and so they were to afflict themselves and to confess their sin before the Lord. Jesus, when he was 12, Luke 2, 41 through 52 tells us that he joined his parents on their trip to Jerusalem for the Passover. In the book of John, Jesus celebrates three separate Passovers in Jerusalem, John 2, John 6, John 11. And, of course, Jesus, his final meal with his disciples was a celebration of Passover as well. All right, let's move on then to question 4. Taylor, this will be for you. What sacrifices and other events were connected to the Feast of Weeks?
Well, I don't have a lot on this because this is almost verbatim what we saw in the previous section. The sacrifices seem to be the very same as those for the unleavened bread. And this is also a repetition of Leviticus 23, verses 15 to 22, as well as some of the Feast of the New Moon sacrifices are repeated here in some forms as well. So there was a burnt offering, there was to be no work, at least at the start, and then there was a grain offering proportioned according to the burnt offerings given.
Okay. Very similar sacrifices, certainly. Lauren.
If I read this right, in Leviticus 23, there was also each family had to offer two loaves of unleavened bread, and then verses 17 to 20.
23:17. You want to read that?
Under the heading Feast of Weeks, you shall bring from your dwellings two weighed loaves and 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be fine flour, they shall be baked and leavened. They are the first fruits of the Lord. That's verse 17. And then you shall sacrifice one kid of the goats as a sin offering. So I think this is a continuation of it.
Right. And as I understand this, this is Pentecost. This was the day that the church was formed, and it was established on the day of Pentecost. But there's also a first fruits back in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the very first Sabbath after the Passover, and that was a barley presentation to the Lord. The people, and this is in Leviticus 23 as well, the priest would present barley, wave barley before the Lord. And later, 50 days later, which was Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks was 50 days after Passover, then they would take wheat and they would wave the wheat before the Lord. And so the first fruits then, Jesus, the first fruits when he was resurrected from the grave, during that first few days after Passover. And then later, the first fruits on the day of Pentecost would be those who were baptized in the church and became Christians. And so obviously there's a wonderful fulfillment of the type of this festival. This feast had been going on for all these years, for 1,500 years, and then they find their fulfillment in Jesus Christ and in the church being established on this day.
Just one other thing about that. What's interesting in Leviticus 23 is that the first fruits, which you mentioned, when they did the grain, just as grain, but it probably was barley. And then in the second one, for Pentecost, they did a wave offering again. But with the wave offering, they included the bread that Lauren mentioned. So that which the people brought was also a wave offering before the Lord.
Which was leavened bread, which is one of the few exceptions. On that day, leavened bread was waved, and many commentators say that represents the Gentiles being incorporated into the kingdom. Whether or not that's true, I'm not sure, but that's an interesting explanation of that on the day of Pentecost. Yes, Bill, you?
Yeah, I think it's the Passover, verse 18, this first time you see this phrase, customary work, and then you see it again in verse 25, and it's mentioned repeatedly, and I was kind of intrigued a little bit by what was customary work, and it sounds like that was work that would be done to provide a living. And so you're not there's a whole bunch of times you're not supposed to do any work that's providing the living. So and then on top of that, my head's starting to try to wrap around the number of animals that are sacrificed. And this is all, there was a lot of commitment and preparation that I don't think we appreciate very well. You know, what had to take place. I mean, everything from, think about how much wood it takes to consume a bull, things like that. I mean, it's pretty interesting, the commitment that the Lord's expecting from his people here.
It's very good. And in fact, I have a Jewish rabbi I listen to. He has a podcast. I've told Shahe about it before. And he's going through the book of Exodus. And talking about the book of Exodus. And Exodus 23 is this very set of feasts and holy convocations. And so I went and listened to it, and he made exactly that point that you just made. It's called servile work or customary work. And he said, under the old covenant, you didn't do your job. So we wouldn't go to our work. We wouldn't, it's a living. You know, it's your job to make your living, you wouldn't do it, but you would still do work. There would be plenty of work that would have to be done to prepare for these sacrifices and just the ordinary, expenditure of energy that everybody has on a normal day. And so he said, the idea that the modern Orthodox Jew has that you can't push a button. You know, I remember when we were riding elevators in Israel, I forget exactly how it worked, but Orthodox Jews aren't even allowed to press a button to take their elevator up, and I'm sure Shahe's seen that as well. So that has been taken completely out of context by modern Jews, and it just meant don't go to your, don't do your job. If you're a farmer, you're not to be out in the fields, with your crop or whatever it is. Shahe.
I mean, not just modern Jews. This was obviously a controversy during Jesus' time. But one of the reasons it was a controversy was, while the phrase no customary work occurs frequently in these two chapters, as Bill said, on the Day of Atonement, the expression is different, which we'll get to here, where in chapter 29, verse 7, it says, you shall not do any work on the Day of Atonement. And then the Jewish scholars made a distinction between the no customary work during the feast and the Sabbath. They said the Sabbath is like atonement. The Day of Atonement, no work at all, which is why on the Sabbath, the Jews during the time of Jesus would protest him working a miracle to heal someone, because that was considered work. So they made a distinction between customary work, which is don't go to your job, your normal job, and any work at all. And that's part of the difficulty for interpreting some of these passages.
Very good. Thank you. I've forgotten about that, but I appreciate you mentioning that, Bill. Any other comments? All right, let's go to question 5 then. And Lauren, this will be for you. What sacrifices and other events were connected to the Feast of Trumpets?
what holy day is being described in verses 7 through 11.
Feast of Trumpets, do no customary work, so it was like a Sabbath day, and there was one bull, one ram, seven lambs, and the grain offerings that went with them, 3 tenths, 2 tenths, 1 tenth of flour, all combined with the wine. These are in addition to the monthly sacrifice. Then on the tenth day, another Sabbath, which is the Day of Atonement, and we can read about that in Leviticus 23:28.
Oh, I really like the Feast of Trumpets. It's the new moon, and you know I've decided this before, and I've done it for a while, and I lost track of the phases of the moon. But I think it'd be interesting to try and track the moon. Of course, the new moon is when it's just beginning to wax again, and 14 days later it's a full moon, and that would have been Passover would have been a full moon. On the 14th day of Nisan. Feast of Trumpets occurs then as the moon is just beginning to appear on that first day. And as I understand it, the trumpets were blown at the beginning of every month, but on this day, the Feast of Trumpets, the trumpets were blown all day long. And I would assume they probably had different priests taking charge of that responsibility. It was a day of joy and excitement because the seventh month of the year, of course, was an exciting month for the Jews, and they all look forward to the events that would occur in the seventh month. And as Lauren has mentioned, the day that is mentioned in the last few verses, the tenth day, then 10 days later after the first day, is the Day of Atonement, and this, of course, is the day that was the National Day of Repentance, as Shah has talked about just a second ago. And the priest would enter the Holy of Holies and sprinkle the blood of the atonement on the mercy seat. As Smith pointed out to us, the scapegoat, Azazel, if I'm saying that correctly, was sent out into the wilderness. And it was a day when people afflicted themselves and confessed their sins before the Lord. And so it was a very important day. Someone pointed out, one of the commentators, Passover gets 9 verses. Feast of Weeks or Pentecost gets 5, and Tabernacles and the Day of Atonement get 28 verses. And so it was a very important time. We're about out of time. Any other comments before we go to the last question? All right. That brings us to question 6. What was the daily breakdown of the Feast of Tabernacles? How does Moses conclude this section of the final 2 verses? Malin.
There are quite a bit of verses here. You see that, you know, there's 8 days of offerings we can read. I'm not going to go through each day, but just some things that I noticed. This feast appears to be set apart, distinguished from some of the other feasts. We see that there's a time when the whole congregation could pour out themselves to the Lord with offerings. And we see the burnt offerings here were a lot more than the normal offerings, and they were in addition to the normal offerings. We also noticed that there were, it was like 70 total bulls that were to be offered throughout the 7-day period, as opposed to the normal 14 days. Last part, how does Moses conclude this section in the final 2 verses? We see that he reminds them that they need to keep what the Lord had commanded. I believe you touched on that earlier. And also to there were other things that they could. It didn't include the vow offerings or the free will offerings either.
Okay. I love this Feast of Tabernacles, just the excitement. The children must have really have enjoyed this because the people would go out and build they'd take palm trees and build booths, and they would live in that for 7 days. And it was a time of great joy, and it must have been a time of great excitement. Jesus, if you want to read John chapter 7, in the Feast of the Tabernacles, that is when he stands and cries out, if anyone thirsts. Apparently there was a ceremony where the high priest would pour out water, and it was on the last day that the
high priest would pour out the water in the temple and make it, it was a big show. It's not found in scripture, but according to history, that's the case. And many think that as that was happening, Jesus stood up and said, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me. So it was a great time of excitement. Any other comments? Yes, Bill.
Yeah, one other thing that I think I picked up on one of the commentators, when I'm reading through and I'm seeing somewhere over 1,000 animals, you know, 3 or 4 animals a day, or, you know, you got a total?
Well, it's 113 bulls, but yeah, this is the...
So I'm looking at all this and I'm seeing, you know, man, the people are really commit. I mean, it's costing them a lot. All this is costing them a lot. And I think one of the commentators pointed out that the Lord was showing them how much they've been blessed. I mean, I was kind of looking at it the wrong way. I was looking at it as my sacrifice, my commitment, but I got, look at what we've got. We're able to do this. And I wasn't looking at it that way before.
Right. Hebrews 13:15. Let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God. The idea that, you know, these Jews, of course, it was a great labor of love to sacrifice all of this to the Lord. And the same is true of us. We're to sacrifice all the things of our life before God. Every decision that we make, every plan that we make, we should plan with God in mind for the grace He's shown us. Yes, David.